over his shoulder as he thrusts a few more times and comes, me realizing it almost too late. Oh, this is his pathetic cum sound, and faking quick oohs and ahs, gentle kittenish noises. I try to work up some tears because I know he imagines me crying with him the first time.
"Darling, you're crying," he says as he slips out of me.
He kisses a tear.
"I'm just happy,"
I say, because that's what those kinds of women say. "I have mixed up some martinis," I announce. Desi loves a decadent afternoon drink. And when he makes a move to put on his shirt and fetch them, I insist he stay in bed.
"I want to do something for you for a change," I say.
So I scamper into the kitchen and get two big martini glasses, and into mine I put gin and a single olive. Into his I put three olives, gin, olive juice, vermouth, and the last of my sleeping pills, three of them, crushed. I bring the martinis, and there is snuggling and nuzzling, and I slurp my gin while this happens. I have an edge that must be dulled.
"Don't you like my martini?" I ask, when he is only a sip. "I always pictured being your wife and making you martinis. I know that's silly."
I begin a pout.
"Oh, darling, not silly at all. I was just taking my time, enjoying. But,"
he guzzles the whole thing down,
"if it makes you feel better."
He is giddy, triumphant. His cock is slick with conquest. He is, basically, like all men. Soon he is sleepy, and after that he is snoring. And I can begin.
Part 3. Boy Gets Girl Back, or Vice Versa. Nick Dunn. 40 Days Gone. Out on bond, awaiting trial. I'd been processed and released. The depersonalized in and outing of jail, the bond hearing, the fingerprints and photos, the rotating and the shuffling and the handling. It didn't make me feel like an animal. It made me feel like a product. Something created on an assembly line. What they were creating was Nick Dunn, killer. It would be months until we'd begin my trial. My trial. The word still threatened to undo me completely, turn me into a high-pitched giggler, a madman. I was supposed to feel privileged to be out on bond. I had stayed put, even when it was clear I was going to be arrested, so I was deemed no flight risk. Boney might have put in a good word for me, too. So I got to be in my own home for a few more months before I was carted off to prison and killed by the state. Yes, I was a lucky, lucky man. It was mid-August, which I found continually strange. It's still summer, I'd think. How can so much have happened, and it's not even autumn? It was brutally warm. Shirt-sleeve weather was how my mom would have described it, forever more concerned with her children's comfort than the actual Fahrenheit. Shirt-sleeve weather, jacket weather, overcoat weather, parka weather, the year in outerwear. For me, this year, it would be handcuff weather, then possibly prison jumpsuit weather, or funeral suit weather, because I didn't plan on going to prison. I'd kill myself first. Tanner had a team of 5 detectives trying to track Amy down. So far, nothing. Like trying to catch water. Every day for weeks, I'd done my little shitty part. Videotape a message to Amy and post it on young Rebecca's whodunit blog. Rebecca, at least, had remained loyal. In the videos, I wore clothes Amy had bought me, and I brushed my hair the way she liked, and I tried to read her mind. My anger toward her was like heated wire. The camera crews parked themselves on my lawn most mornings. We were like rival soldiers, rooted in shooting distance for months, eyeing each other across no man's land, achieving some sort of perverted fraternity. There was one guy with a voice like a cartoon strongman whom I'd become attached to, sight unseen. He was dating a girl he really, really liked. Every morning his voice boomed in through my windows as he analyzed their dates. Things seemed to be going very well. I wanted to hear how the story ended. I finished my evening taping to Amy. I was wearing a green shirt she liked on me, and I'd been telling her the story of how we first met, the party in Brooklyn, my awful opening line, "Just one olive," that embarrassed me every time Amy mentioned it. I talked about our exit from the oversteamed apartment out into the crackling cold, with her hand in mine, the kiss in the cloud of sugar. It was one of the few stories we told the same way. I said it all in the cadence of a bedtime tale, soothing and familiar and repetitive, always ending with, "Come home to me, Amy." I turned off the camera and sat back on the couch. I always filmed while sitting on the couch under her pernicious, unpredictable cuckoo clock, because I knew if I didn't show her cuckoo clock, she'd wonder whether I had finally gotten rid of her cuckoo clock, and then she'd stop wondering whether I had finally gotten rid of her cuckoo clock and simply come to believe it was true. And then, no matter what sweet words came out of my mouth, she'd silently counter with, "And yet he tossed out my cuckoo clock." The cuckoo was, in fact, soon to pop out, its grinding wind-up beginning over my head, a sound that inevitably made my jaw tense, when the camera crews outside emitted a loud, collective, oceanic whooshing. Somebody was here. I heard the seagull cries of a few female news anchors. "Something is wrong," I thought. The doorbell rang 3 times in a row. "Nick, Nick! Nick, Nick! Nick, Nick!" I didn't hesitate. I had stopped hesitating over the past month. Bring on the trouble post-haste. I opened the door. It was my wife. Back. Amy Elliott Dunn stood barefoot on my doorstep in a thin pink dress that clung to her as if it were wet. Her ankles were ringed in dark violet. From one limp wrist dangled a piece of twine. Her hair was short and frayed at the ends, as if it had been carelessly chopped by dull scissors. Her face was bruised, her lips swollen. She was sobbing. When she flung her arms out toward me, I could see her entire midsection was stained with dried blood. She tried to speak. Her mouth opened once, twice, silent. A mermaid washed ashore. "Nick!" she finally keened, a wail that echoed against all the empty houses and fell into my arms. I wanted to kill her. Had we been alone, my hands might have found their place around her neck, my fingers locating perfect grooves in her flesh. To feel that strong pulse under my fingers. But we weren't alone. We were in front of cameras, and they were realizing who this strange woman was. They were coming to life as sure as the cuckoo clock inside. A few clicks, a few questions, then an avalanche of noise and light. The cameras were blasting us, The reporters closing in with microphones, everyone yelling Amy's name, screaming, literally screaming. So I did the right thing. I held her to me and howled her name right back. Amy! My God! My God! My darling! And buried my face in her neck, my arms wrapped tight around her, and let the cameras get their 15 seconds, and I whispered deep inside her ear, "You fucking bitch." Then I stroked her hair. I cupped her face in my two loving hands, and I yanked her inside. Outside our door, a rock concert was demanding its encore.
Amy! Amy! Amy!
Someone threw a scattering of pebbles at our window.
Amy! Amy! Amy!
My wife took it all as her due, fluttering a dismissive hand toward the rabble outside. She turned to me with a worn but triumphant smile, a smile on the rape victim, the abuse survivor, the bed burner in the old TV movies, the smile where the bastard has finally received due justice, and we know our heroine will be able to move on with life. Freeze frame. I gestured to the twine, the hacked hair, the dried blood. So, what's your story, wife?
I'm back, she whimpered. I made it back to you.
She moved to put her arms around me. I moved away. What is your story, Amy?
Desi,
she whispered, her lower lip trembling.
Desi Collings took me. It was the morning of our anniversary. And the doorbell rang and I thought maybe it was flowers from you.
I flinched. Of course she'd find a way to work in a gripe, that I hardly ever sent her flowers, when her dad had sent her mom flowers each week since they'd been married. That's 2,444 bouquets of flowers versus 4.
Flowers or something,
she continued.
So I didn't think. I just flung open the door, and there he stood, Desi, with this look on his face, determined, as if he'd been girding himself up for this all along. And I was holding the handle to the Judy puppet. Did you find the puppets?
She smiled up at me tearily. She looked so sweet. Oh, I found everything you left for me, Amy.
I had just found the handle to the Judy puppet. It had fallen off. I was holding it when I opened the door, and I tried to hit him, and we struggled, and he clubbed me with it, hard. And the next thing I knew...
You had framed me for murder and disappeared.
I can explain everything, Nick.
I stared at her a long, hard moment. I saw days under the hot sun stretched across the sand of the beach, her hand on my chest, and I saw family dinners at her parents' house, with Rand always refilling my glass and patting me on the shoulder, and I saw us sprawled on the rug in my crummy New York apartment, talking while staring at the lazy ceiling fan, and I saw mother of my child and the stunning life I'd planned for us once. I had a moment that lasted 2 beats. 1, 2. When I wished violently that she were telling the truth. I actually don't think you can explain everything, I said. But I'm going to love watching you try.
Try me now.
She tried to take my hand, and I flung her off. I walked away from her, took a breath, and then turned to face her. My wife must always be faced.
Go ahead, Nick. Try me now.
Okay, sure. Why was every clue of the treasure hunt hidden in a place where I had relations with Andy? She sighed, looked at the floor. Her ankles were raw.
I didn't even know about Andy until I saw it on TV, while I was tied to Desi's bed, hidden away in his lake house.
So that was all coincidence?
Those were all places that were meaningful to us, she said.
A tear slid down her face.
Your office, where you reignited your passion for journalism?
I snuffed.
Hannibal, where I finally understood how much this area means to you. Your father's house, confronting the man who hurt you so much. Your mother's house, which is now Go's house. The two people who made you such a good man. But I guess it doesn't surprise me that you'd like to share those places with someone you...
She bowed her head.
...had fallen in love with. You always liked repeats.
Why did each of those places end up including clues that implicated me in your murder? Women's undies, your purse, your diary. Explain your diary, Amy, with all the lies. She just smiled and shook her head like she was sorry for me.
Everything. I can explain everything, she said.
I looked in that sweet, tear-stained face. Then I looked down at all the blood. Amy, where's Desi? She shook her head again, a sad little smile. I moved to call the police, but a knock on our door told me they were already here.
Amy Elliott Dunn, The Night of the Return. I still have Desi's semen inside me from the last time he raped me, so the medical examination goes fine. My rope-wreathed wrists, my damaged vagina, my bruises, the body I present them is textbook. An older male doctor with humid breath and thick fingers performs the pelvic exam, scraping and wheezing in time, while Detective Rhonda Boney holds my hand. It is like being clutched by a cold bird claw, not comforting at all. Once she breaks into a grin when she thinks I'm not looking. She is absolutely thrilled that Nick isn't a bad guy after all. Yes, the women of America are collectively sighing. Police have been dispatched to Desi's home, where they'll find him naked and drained, a stunned look on his face, a few strands of my hair in his clutches, the bed soaked in blood. The knife I used on him, and on my bonds, will be nearby on the floor where I dropped it, dazed, and walked barefoot, carrying nothing out of the house but his keys, to the car, to the gate, and climbed, still slick with his blood, into his vintage Jaguar, and returned like some long-lost faithful pet, straight back home to my husband. I'd been reduced to an animal state. I didn't think of anything but getting back to Nick. The old doctor tells me the good news. No permanent damage and no need for a DNC. I miscarried too early. Boney keeps clutching my hand and murmuring, "My God, what you've been through. Do you think you feel up to answering a few questions?" That fast, from condolences to brass tacks. I find ugly women are usually overly deferential or incredibly rude. "You are amazing, Amy, and you've survived a brutal kidnapping involving repeated assaults. You've killed your captor, and you've made it back to a husband you've discovered was cheating. You, A, put yourself first and demand some time alone to collect yourself. B, hold it together just a little longer so you can help the police. C, decide which interview to give first, You might as well get something out of the ordeal, like a book deal. Answer B. Amazing Amy always puts others first. I'm allowed to clean myself up in a private room in the hospital, and I change into a set of clothes Nick put together for me from the house. Jeans with creases from being folded too long, a pretty blouse that smells of dust. Boney and I drive from the hospital to the police station in near silence. I ask, weakly, after my parents.
"They're waiting for you at the station," Boney says. "They wept when I told them, with joy, absolute joy and relief. We'll let them get some good hugs in with you before we do our questions. Don't worry."
The cameras are already at the station. The parking lot has that hopeful, overlit look of a sports stadium. There is no underground parking, so we have to pull right up front as the madding crowd closes in. I see wet lips and spittle as everyone screams questions, the pops of flashbulbs and camera lights. The crowd pushes and pulls en masse, jerking a few inches to the right, then the left, as everyone tries to reach me. "I can't do this," I say to Boney. A man's meaty palm smacks against the car window as a photographer tries to keep his balance. I grab her cold hand. "It's too much." She pats me and says,
"Wait."
The station doors open, and every officer in the building files down the stairs and forms a line on either side of me, holding the press back, creating an honor guard for me. And Rhonda and I run in holding hands like reverse newlyweds, rushing straight up to my parents, who are waiting just inside the doorway, and everyone gets the photos of us clutching each other with my mom whispering,
"Sweet girl, sweet girl, sweet girl,"
and my dad sobbing so loudly he almost chokes. There is more whisking away of me, as if I haven't been whisked away quite enough already. I am deposited in a closet of a room with comfortable but cheap office chairs, the kind that always seem to have bits of old food woven into the fabric. A camera blinking up in the corner, and no windows. It is not what I pictured. It is not designed to make me feel safe. I am surrounded by Boney, her partner, Gilpin, and two FBI agents up from St. Louis who remain nearly silent. They give me water, and then Boney starts. B.
"Okay, Amy. First, we have to thank you sincerely for talking with us after what you've been through. In a case like this, it's very important to get everything down while the memory is fresh. You can't imagine how important that is. So it's good to talk now. If we can get all these details down, we can close the case, and you and Nick can go back to your lives."
A. "I'd definitely like that."
B. "You deserve that. So, if you're ready to begin, can we start with the timeline? What time did Desi arrive at your door? Do you remember?"
A. "About 10 a.m. A little after, because I remember hearing the Taverers talking as they walked to their car for church."
B. "What happened when you opened the door?"
A. "Something felt wrong immediately. First of all, Desi has written me letters all my life, but his obsession seemed to have become less intense over the years. He seemed to think of himself as just an old friend, and since the police couldn't do anything about it, I made my peace with that. I never felt like he meant me active harm, although I really didn't like being this close to him, geographically. I think that's what put him over the edge, knowing I was so close. He walked into my house with... He was sweaty and sort of nervous, but also determined-looking. I'd been upstairs. I'd been about to iron my dress when I noticed the big wooden handle of the Judy puppet on the floor. I guess it had fallen off. Bummer, because I'd already hidden the puppets in the woodshed. So I grabbed the handle, and I had that in my hand when I opened the door. B.
Very good memory.
A. Thank you. B.
What happened next?
A. Desi barged in, and he was pacing around the living room, all flustered and kind of frantic, and he said, "What are you doing for your anniversary?" It frightened me that he knew today was our anniversary, and he seemed angry about it. And then his arm flashed out, and he had me by the wrist and was twisting it behind my back, and we struggled. I put up a real fight.
B. What next?
A. I kicked him and got away for a second and ran to the kitchen, and we struggled more, and he clubbed me once with the big wooden Judy handle, and I went flying, and then he hit me two or three more times. I remember not being able to see for a second, just dizzy. My head was throbbing, and I tried to grab for the handle, and he stabbed my arm with this pocket knife he was carrying. I still have the scar. See?
B. Yes, that was noted in your medical examination. You were lucky it was only a flesh wound.
A. It doesn't feel like a flesh wound, believe me.
B. So, he stabbed you? The angle is...
A. I'm not sure if he did it on purpose, or if I thrust myself onto the blade accidentally. I was so off balance. I remember the club falling to the floor, though, and I looked down and saw my blood from the stab wound pooling over the club. I think I passed out then.
B. Where were you when you woke up?
A. I woke up hogtied in my living room.
B. Did you scream? Try to get the neighbor's attention?
A. Of course I screamed. I mean, did you hear me? I was beaten, stabbed, and hogtied by a man who had been obsessed with me for decades, who once tried to kill himself in my dorm bedroom.
B. Okay. Amy, I'm sorry. That question was not intended in the least to sound like we are blaming you. We just need to get a full picture here so we can close the investigation and you can get on with your life. Do you want another water or coffee or something?
A. Something warm would be nice. I'm so cold.
B. No problem. Can you get her a coffee? So, what happened then?
A. I think his original plan was to subdue me and kidnap me and let it look like a runaway wife thing, because when I wake up, he's just finished mopping the blood in the kitchen, and he straightened the table of little antique ornaments that fell over when I ran to the kitchen. He's gotten rid of the club, but he's running out of time, and I think what must have happened is he sees this disheveled living room, and so he thinks, leave it. Let it look like something bad happened here. So he throws the front door open, and then he knocks a few more things over in the living room, overturns the ottoman. So that's why the scene looked so weird. It was half true and half false.
B. Did Desi plant incriminating items at each of the treasure hunt sites? Nick's office, Hannibal, his dad's house, Go's woodshed?
A. I don't know what you mean.
B. There was a pair of women's underwear, not your size, in Nick's office.
A. I guess it must have been the girl he was dating.
B. Not hers either.
A. Well, I can't help on that one. Maybe he was seeing more than one girl.
B. Your diary was found in his father's house, partly burned in the furnace.
A. Did you read the diary? It's awful. I'm sure Nick did want to get rid of it. I don't blame him, considering you guys zeroed in on him so quickly.
B. I wonder why he would go to his father's to burn it.
A. You should ask him.
Pause.
Nick went there a lot, to be alone. He likes his privacy, so I'm sure it didn't feel that odd to him. I mean, he couldn't do it at our house because it's a crime scene. Who knows if you guys will come back, find something in the ashes. At his dad's, he has some discretion. I thought it was a smart move, considering you guys were basically railroading him.
B. The diary is very, very concerning. The diary alleges abuse and your fears that Nick didn't want the baby, that he might want to kill you.
A. I really do wish that diary had burned.
Pause.
Let me be honest. The diary includes some of Nick's and my struggles these past few years. It doesn't paint the greatest picture of our marriage or of Nick. But I have to admit, I never wrote in the diary unless I was super happy or I was really, really unhappy and wanted to vent. And then I can get a little dramatic when it's just me stewing on things. I mean, a lot of that is the ugly truth. He did shove me once, and he didn't want a baby, and he did have money problems. But me being afraid of him? I have to admit, it pains me to admit, but that's my dramatic streak. I think the problem is, I've been stalked several times. It's been a lifelong issue. People getting obsessed with me, and so I get a little paranoid.
B. You tried to buy a gun.
A. I get a lot paranoid, okay? I'm sorry. If you had my history, you'd understand.
B. There's an entry about a night of drinks when you suffered from what sounds like textbook antifreeze poisoning.
A. Long silence. That's bizarre. Yes, I did get ill.
B. Okay, back to the treasure hunt. You did hide the Punch and Judy dolls in the woodshed?
A. I did.
B. A lot of our case has focused on Nick's debt, some extensive credit card purchases, and our discovery of all those items hidden in the woodshed. What did you think when you opened the woodshed and saw all this stuff?
A. I was on Go's property, and Go and I aren't especially close, so mostly I felt like I was nosing around in something that wasn't my business. I remember thinking at the time that it must have been her stuff from New York. And then I saw on the news, Desi made me watch everything, that it corresponded with Nick's purchases, and I knew Nick had some money troubles. He was a spender. I think he was probably embarrassed. Impulse purchases he couldn't undo, so he hid them from me until he could sell them online.
B. The Punch and Judy puppets, they seem a little ominous for an anniversary present.
A. I know. Now I know. I didn't remember the whole backstory of Punch and Judy. I was just seeing a husband and wife and a baby, and they were made of wood, and I was pregnant. I scanned the internet and saw Punch's line, "That's the way to do it," and I thought it was cute. I didn't know what it meant.
B. So you were hogtied. How did Desi get you to the car?
A. He pulled the car into the garage and lowered the garage door, dragged me in, threw me in the trunk, and drove away.
B. And did you yell then?
A. Yes, I fucking yelled. And if I'd known that every night for the next month, Desi was going to rape me, then snuggle in next to me with a martini and a sleeping pill so he wouldn't be awakened by my sobbing, and that the police were going to actually interview him and still not have a clue, still sit around with their thumbs up their asses, I might have yelled harder. Yes, I might have.
B. Again, my apologies. Can we get Ms. Dunn some tissues, please? And where's her cough? Thank you. Okay, where did you go from there, Amy?
A. We drove towards St. Louis, and I remember on the way there, he stopped at Hannibal. I heard the steamboat whistle. I guess that's when he threw my purse out. It was the one other thing he did so it would look like foul play.
B. This is so interesting. There seem to be so many strange coincidences in this case. Like, that Desi would happen to toss out the purse right at Hannibal, where your clue would make Nick go, and we, in turn, would believe that Nick tossed the purse there. Or how you decided to hide a present in the very place where Nick was hiding goods he'd bought on secret credit cards.
A. Really? I have to tell you, none of this sounds like coincidence to me. It sounds like a bunch of cops who got hung up on my husband being guilty, and now that I am alive and he's clearly not guilty, they look like giant idiots, and they're scrambling to cover their asses. Instead of accepting responsibility for the fact that if this case had been left in your extremely fucking incompetent hands, Nick would be on death row and I'd be chained to a bed being raped every day from now until I died.
B. I'm sorry. It's...
A. I saved myself, which saved Nick, which saved your sorry fucking asses.
B. That is an incredibly good point, Amy. I'm sorry, we've spent so long on this case, we want to figure out every detail that we missed so we don't repeat our mistakes. But you're absolutely right. We're missing the big picture, which is, you are a hero. You are an absolute hero.
A. Thank you. I appreciate you saying that.
Nick Dunn, The Night of the Return. I went to the station to fetch my wife and was greeted by the press like a rock star, landslide president, first moonwalker, all in one. I had to resist raising clasped hands above my head in the universal victory shake. I see, I thought. We're all pretending to be friends now. I entered a scene that felt like a holiday party gone awry. A few bottles of champagne rested on one desk, surrounded by tiny paper cups. Backslapping and cheers for all the cops, and then more cheers for me, as if these people hadn't been my persecutors a day before. But I had to play along. Present the back for slapping. Oh yes, we're all buddies now. All that matters is that Amy is safe. I'd been practicing that line over and over. I had to look like the relieved, doting husband until I knew which way things were going to go. Until I was sure the police had sawed through all her sticky, cobwebby lies. Until she is arrested. I'd get that far. Until she is arrested, and then I could feel my brain expand and deflate simultaneously, my own cerebral Hitchcock zoom, and I'd think, my wife murdered a man. Stabbed him, said the young police officer assigned as the family liaison. I hoped never to be liaisoned again with anyone for any reason. He was the same kid who'd yammered on to Go about his horse and torn labrum and peanut allergy. Cut him right through the jugular. Cut like that, he bleeds out in, like, 60 seconds. 60 seconds is a long time to know you were dying. I could picture Desi wrapping his hands around his neck, the feel of his own blood spurting between his fingers with each pulse, and Desi getting more frightened, and the pulsing only quickening, and then slowing, and Desi knowing the slowing was worse. And all the time, Amy standing just out of reach, studying him with the blameful, disgusted look of a high school biology student confronted with a dripping pig fetus, her little scalpel still in hand. "Cut him with a big old butcher knife," the kid was saying. "Guy used to sit right next to her on the bed, cut up her meat for her, and feed her." He sounded more disgusted by this than by the stabbing. "One day the knife slips off the plate. He never notices." "How'd she use the knife if she was always tied up?" I asked. The kid looked at me as if I'd just told a joke about his mother. "I don't know, Mr. Dunn. I'm sure they're getting the details right now. The point is, your wife is safe." Hooray. Kid stole my line. I spotted Rand and Mary Beth through the doorway of the room where we'd given our first press conference 6 weeks ago. They were leaning into each other, as always, Rand kissing the top of Mary Beth's head, Mary Beth nuzzling him back, and I felt such a keen sense of outrage that I almost threw a stapler at them. "You two worshipful, adoring assholes created that thing down the hall and set her loose on the world. Lo, how jolly, what a perfect monster. And do they get punished?" No, not a single person had come forth to question their characters. They'd experienced nothing but an outpouring of love and support, and Amy would be restored to them, and everyone would love her more. My wife was an insatiable sociopath before. What would she become now? "Step carefully, Nick. Step very carefully." Rand caught my eye and motioned me to join them. He shook my hand for a few exclusive reporters who'd been granted an audience. Mary Beth held her ground. I was still the man who'd cheated on her daughter. She gave a curt nod and turned away. Rand leaned in close to me so I could smell his spearmint gum.
"I tell you, Nick, we are so relieved to have Amy back. We owe you an apology, too. Big one. We'll let Amy decide how she feels about your marriage, but I want to at least apologize for where things went. You've got to understand."
"I do," I said. "I understand everything." Before Rand could apologize or engage further, Tanner and Betsy arrived together, looking like a Vogue spread, crisp slacks and jewel-toned shirts and gleaming gold watches and rings. And Tanner leaned toward my ear and whispered,
"Let me see where we are."
And then Go was rushing in, all alarmed eyes and questions. "What does this mean? What happened to Desi? She just showed up on your doorstep? What does this mean? Are you okay? What happens next?" It was a bizarre gathering. The feel of it, not quite reunion, not quite hospital waiting room, celebratory yet anxious, like some parlor game where no one had all the rules. Meanwhile, the two reporters the Elliots allowed into the inner sanctum kept snapping questions at me.
"How great does it feel to have Amy back?"
"How wonderful do you feel right now?"
"How relieved are you, Nick, that Amy has returned?"
"I'm extremely relieved and very happy," I was saying, crafting my own bland PR statement, when the doors parted and Jacqueline Collings entered, her lips a tight red scar, her face powder-lined with tears.
"Where is she?"
she said to me.
"The lying little bitch, where is she? She killed my son! My son!"
She began crying as the reporter snapped a few photos. "How do you feel that your son was accused of kidnap and rape?" one reporter asked in a stiff voice.
"How do I feel?" she snapped. "Are you actually serious? Do people really answer questions like that? That nasty, soulless girl manipulated my son his entire life. Write this down. She manipulated and lied and finally murdered him, and now, even after he's dead, she's still using him."
"Miss Collings, we're Amy's parents," Mary Beth was beginning. She tried to touch Jacqueline on the shoulder, and Jacqueline shook her off. "I am sorry for your pain."
"But not my loss."
Jacqueline stood a good head taller than Mary Beth. She glared down on her.
"But not my loss," she reasserted.
"I'm sorry about everything," Mary Beth said. And then Rand was next to her, a head taller than Jacqueline.
"What are you going to do about your daughter?" Jacqueline asked.
She turned toward our young liaison officer, who tried to hold his ground.
"What is being done about Amy? Because she is lying when she says my son kidnapped her. She is lying. She killed him. She murdered him in his sleep. And no one seems to be taking this seriously."
"It's all being taken very, very seriously, ma'am," the young kid said.
"Can I get a quote, Ms. Collings?" asked the reporter. "I just gave you my quote. Amy Elliott Dunn murdered my son. It was not self-defense. She murdered him."
"Do you have proof of that?" Of course she didn't. The reporter's story would chronicle my husbandly exhaustion, his drawn face telling of too many nights forfeited to fear, and the Elliots' relief. The two parents cling to each other as they wait for their only child to be officially returned to them. It would discuss the incompetence of the cops. It was a biased case, full of dead ends and wrong turns, with the police department focused doggedly on the wrong man. The article would dismiss Jacqueline Collings in a single line. After an awkward run-in with the Elliott parents, an embittered Jacqueline Collings was ushered out of the room, claiming her son was innocent. Jacqueline was indeed ushered out of the room into another, where her statement would be recorded, and she would be kept out of the way of the much better story, the triumphant return of Amazing Amy. When Amy was released to us, it all began again. The photos and the tears, the hugging and the laughter, all for strangers who wanted to see and to know.
"What was it like? Amy, what does it feel like to escape your captor and return to your husband? Nick, what does it feel like to get your wife back, to get your freedom back all at once?"
I remained mostly silent. I was thinking my own questions, the same questions I'd thought for years, the ominous refrain of our marriage. "What are you thinking, Amy? How are you feeling? Who are you? What have we done to each other? What will we do?" It was a gracious, queenly act for Amy to want to come home to our marriage bed with her cheating husband. Everyone agreed. The media followed us as if we were a royal wedding procession, the two of us whizzing through the neon, fast-food-cluttered streets of Carthage to our McMansion on the river. What grace Amy has, What moxie! A storybook princess. And I, of course, was the lickspittle hunchback of a husband who would bow and scrape the rest of my days until she was arrested. If she ever got arrested. That she was released at all was a concern. More than a concern, an utter shock. I saw them all filing out of the conference room where they questioned her for 4 hours and then let her go. 2 FBI guys with alarmingly short hair and blank faces, Gilpin looking like he'd swallowed the greatest steak dinner of his life, and Boney, the only one with thin, tight lips and a little V of a frown. She glanced at me as she walked past, arched an eyebrow, and was gone. Then, too quickly, Amy and I were back in our home, alone in the living room, Bleeker watching us with shiny eyes. Outside our curtains, the lights of the TV cameras remained, bathing our living room in a bizarrely lush orange glow. We looked candlelit, romantic. Amy was absolutely beautiful. I hated her. I was afraid of her. "We can't really sleep in the same house," I began.
"I want to stay here with you."
She took my hand.
"I want to be with my husband. I want to give you the chance to be the kind of husband you want to be. I forgive you."
"You forgive me? Amy, why did you come back? Because of what I said in the interviews? The videos?"
"Wasn't that what you wanted?"
she said.
"Wasn't that the point of the videos? They were perfect. They reminded me of what we used to have, how special it was."
"What I said, that was just me saying what you wanted to hear."
"I know. That's how well you know me," Amy said.
She beamed. Bleeker began figure-eighting between her legs. She picked him up and stroked him. His purr was deafening.
"Think about it, Nick. We know each other better than anyone in the world now."
It was true that I'd had this feeling, too, in the past month, when I wasn't wishing Amy harm. It would come to me at strange moments, in the middle of the night, up to take a piss, or in the morning, pouring a bowl of cereal. I'd detect a nib of admiration, and more than that, fondness for my wife, right in the middle of me, right in the gut. To know exactly what I wanted to hear in those notes, to woo me back to her, even to predict all my wrong moves. The woman knew me cold. Better than anyone in the world, she knew me. All this time I'd thought we were strangers, and it turned out we knew each other intuitively. In our bones, in our blood. It was kind of romantic, catastrophically romantic. "We can't just pick up where we were, Amy."
"No, not where we were," she said. "Where we are now. Where you love me, and you'll never do wrong again."
"You're crazy. You're literally crazy if you think I'm going to stay." "You killed a man," I said. I turned my back to her, and then I pictured her with a knife in her hand and her mouth growing tight as I disobeyed her. I turned back around. Yes, my wife must always be faced.
"To escape him."
"You killed Desi so you had a new story, so you could come back and be beloved Amy and not ever have to take the blame for what you did. Don't you get it, Amy? The irony? It's what you always hated about me. That I never dealt with the consequences of my actions, right? Well, my ass has been well and duly consequenced.
So what about you? You murdered a man. A man I assume loved you and was helping you. And now you want me to step in his place and love you and help you and... I can't. I cannot do it. I won't do it.
Nick, I think you've gotten some bad information, she said. It doesn't surprise me, all the rumors that are going about. But we need to forget all that. If we are to go forward, and we will go forward, all of America wants us to go forward. It's the story the world needs right now. Us. Desi's the bad guy. No one wants two bad guys. They want to like you, Nick. The only way you can be loved again is to stay with me. It's the only way.
Tell me what happened, Amy. Was Desi helping you all along? She flared at that. She didn't need a man's help, even though she clearly had needed a man's help.
Of course not, she snapped.
Tell me. What can it hurt? Tell me everything. Because you and I can't go forward with this pretend story. I'll fight you every step of the way. I know you've thought of everything. I'm not trying to get you to slip up. I'm tired of trying to outthink you. I don't have it in me. I just want to know what happened. I was a step away from death row, Amy. You came back and saved me, and I thank you for that. Do you hear me? I thank you. So don't say I didn't later on. I thank you. But I need to know. You know I need to know.
Take off your clothes, she said.
She wanted to make sure I wasn't wearing a wire. I undressed in front of her, removed every stitch, and then she surveyed me, ran a hand across my chin and my chest, down my back. She palmed my ass and slipped her hand between my legs, cupped my testicles and gripped my limp cock, held it in her hand for a moment to see if anything happened. Nothing happened. You're clean, she said. It was meant as a joke, a wisecrack, a movie reference we'd both laugh at. When I said nothing, she stepped back and said, I always did like looking at you naked. That made me happy. Nothing made you happy. Can I put my clothes back on? No. I don't want to worry about hidden wires in the cuffs or the hems. Also, we need to go in the bathroom and run the water, in case you bugged the house. You've seen too many movies, I said.
Ha! Never thought I'd hear you say that.
We stood in the bathtub and turned on the shower. The water sprayed my naked back and misted the front of Amy's shirt until she peeled it off. She pulled off all her clothes, a gleeful striptease, and tossed them over the shower stall in the same grinning, game manner she had when we first met. I'm up for anything. And she turned to me, and I waited for her to swing her hair around her shoulders like she did when she flirted with me. But her hair was too short.
Now we're even, she said. Seemed rude to be the only one clothed.
I think we're past etiquette, Amy. Look only at her eyes. Do not touch her. Do not let her touch you. She moved toward me, put a hand on my chest, let the water trickle between her breasts. She licked a shower teardrop off her upper lip and smiled. Amy hated shower spray. She didn't like getting her face wet, didn't like the feel of water pelleting her flesh. I knew this because I was married to her, and I'd pawed her and harassed her many times in the shower, always to be turned down.
I know it seems sexy, Nick, but it's actually not. It's something people only do in movies.
Now she was pretending just the opposite.